I next met with Dr. Harvey Pass for a surgical thoracic oncology perspective, and he began our conversation by presenting a patient from his practice.
The first case is a 72-year-old patient who was a previous smoker. He quit 15 years ago. He had a previous partial laryngectomy for an ear, nose, and throat malignancy 3 years ago. He's got a follow-up PET CT being followed for his ENT malignancy, and it shows a lesion in the left lower lobe medially, and he's also got a subcarinal lymph node that is hot on PET. So the question is what to do about this patient. He had a EBUS mediastinoscopy. We found that he had a level 7 lymph node that was squamous cell carcinoma, and treated him with 60 gray of concurrent chemo radiation therapy with cisatopicide. We went ahead and biopsied other lymph nodes with EBUS at the time of the initial workup and found that he didn't have any other disease.
Now, was the first tissue obtained by EBUS or through bronchoscopy?
That's a great question. I mean, the way that we do it is that we start with EBUS. And if there's any question on the rapid on-site evaluation, which means that we look at the cytology at the time of the operation, like as a frozen section, we put it on a slide, we take it down to pathology, and we look at it immediately. If we have lymphocytes, it's great, we're in the lymph node, but if we don't have a positive diagnosis and we got a PET scan that's positive, then we're not satisfied. So we need to go ahead and then convert to a mediastinoscopy at that point because we don't believe it. In other words, if you have a PET positive documented lymph node, then you better be sure that you're doing it. Now, that's a problem because it sort of screws up your pre-operative evaluation, which is what at least I believe in at this point. I'd like to start with an EBUS and do the mediastinoscopy later.
But typically, for example, you won't biopsy the primary, you go right into the mediastinum?
That's correct. In other words, if we have a patient with suspicious mediastinal lymph nodes, we'll start with the lymph nodes to see if we can go ahead and get a diagnosis there.
Any comments on the technique of EBUS? Does everybody do it the same? Are there some potential problems?
That's a really great question. It's a learning curve of about 50 cases, first of all. Second of all, you need to do EBUS when you start out on cases that you know you're going to be able to get. So PET positive, large lymph nodes. As you do them, you learn little pearls techniques. The needle system is good, but it's not great. It's a 22-gauge needle, and it has an inner stylet that goes all the way down, and then you introduce it into the lymph node. Once you're through into the lymph node, you've got to take the inner stylet and sort of push the stuff, any stuff that's at the end of the needle out, or else you may have bronchial epithelium that will be sucked in, and then you'll get a false negative. So you do that technique first, and then the second thing is that you really need to do at least 2 or 3 aspirates. It's classic that you should do 3 aspirates of the same lymph node to make sure you don't have sampling error.
Now, this is flexible bronchoscopy?
It's a flexible bronchoscopy with a linear ultrasound so that you can look beyond the bronchus and see the lymph nodes.
How would you compare the morbidity of EBUS versus mediastinoscopy?
I think that certainly EBUS is less. I mean, there's really no complications with EBUS that have been steadily reported. The one that is most feared that has been reported a couple of times is an ascending mediastinitis, believe it or not, in which you've biopsied the lymph node and for some reason the mediastinum then gets infected. There have been 2 or 3 cases in the literature of that. So that compared to the usual worry about bleeding with mediastinoscopy, worry about recurrent laryngeal nerve, there's really no comparison. The morbidity is much less.
So essentially the idea is it's a less morbid procedure. If you can get a positive diagnosis, you save the morbidity. But if you don't, you still pretty much need to do mediastinoscopy.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. Now, it's really user-directed. There are certain people who have done a lot of these who are absolute experts, and that is where the field's going to go. The field is going to go where this initial evaluation is done by people who've done so many that the sensitivity is going to be very, very high.
Now, as a non-surgeon, I'm trying to visualize this. How do you, I know it sounds sort of weird, but how do you find the node? I mean, do you feel it or?
No, because you have a special scope that has the ultrasound probe at the end of it, you are literally looking outside the bronchial wall, and you can see the different levels as you angle the scope toward the bronchial wall. There's a balloon that also aids you. The interface of a water interface instead of an air interface makes the resolution better. Plus the fact it's built in with a Doppler flow so that you can see blood vessels, so that you can make sure you're not going to stick your needle directly into a blood vessel. You're going to stick it directly into the node.
And what's the time? How long does it take to do it usually?
Oh, I think that it takes longer than you think. I mean, if you're doing rapid on-site evaluation, it can take about 40 minutes to an hour and a half if you're doing multiple lymph nodes, because you're aspirating the lymph node. You're doing at least three. You're finding the lymph nodes. You're preparing the slides. You're then getting the slides read. I mean, it can be as long as a mediastinoscopy, if not longer.
And I guess you repeatedly go back and insert the scope. You go down to the lab and you come back and you reintroduce it.
That's correct. So you get a certain station, you can go ahead and you can either biopsy that station and then change needles so you're not going to have cross-contamination of lymph node stations. You don't want to take the same needle for a level 7 and use it for a level 4 because you potentially could cross-contaminate. So you use a different needle. You could do all the lymph nodes at one time and then prepare a series of slides, 4, 7, 2 levels, and then take them all down and look at them.
So once this procedure had been completed on this patient, what were your assessment of the options?
So I have a patient that with my biopsies, mediastinoscopy and EBUS, although mediastinoscopy was the true positive, I have single level disease. So it's either operation or treatment at this point with the idea that it's an induction and you may be able to operate on the patient later. At our institution, if we know that we have a positive lymph node, then we like to give induction first and then operate. We're not of the ilk that if you have a known single station lymph node, to simply go ahead and operate on the patient.
What kind of induction and what are you looking for in terms of effect?
So we believe, although we have different protocols, the majority of the time patients are getting cisplatinum etoposide. That's changed recently.
Without radiation?
That's with radiation. And even with patients with single lymph nodes, it's a very important point because we do think that the radiation does add to the local control. So the SWOG cassette is usually the choice at our institution. There are other choices that you can use now with, this is a patient, really squamous cell carcinoma, so probably was treated correctly getting etoposide platinum, but if it was an adenocarcinoma, people have moved toward giving pemetrexed and platinum.
What's the objective in the induction therapy? I mean, can it change the procedure? Are you trying to sort of see whether or not the disease is going to explode on you? What are you trying to do?
So, Neil, I think that the theory that you can change the procedure is one that sort of has been blown out of the water. I mean, there have been a number of induction trials, even in early stage disease. The randomized trial that was done for less than 3A disease that showed that in both arms, the induction arm or the regular surgery arm, there was no difference in the number of pneumonectomies. So we sort of don't believe at this point that you can tell a patient that if we treat you, we're going to convert you from a pneumonectomy to a lobectomy. What you're trying to accomplish, in my opinion, is to have a sterilization of the mediastinum. Now, that may seem weird because you've got a primary tumor also, but what seems to be one of the more important prognostic signs in all the studies that have been done is that if you're able to have a rip-roaring response in the mediastinum, meaning you're sterilizing the lymph nodes that were positive that then become negative on rebiopsy or thoracotomy, then those patients seem to have a doubling of survival in the surgical series. So the point is a response that is histologically proven to be a near CR in the mediastinum.
Any sense clinically or data from the literature in terms of what induction does to surgical morbidity?
Yes, and there's been a lot of discussion on that. There's two categories of the induction, of course. There's induction chemotherapy and induction chemoradiation therapy. Essentially, induction chemotherapy increases your morbidity from a, if it's a lobectomy, the ongoing rate for a lobectomy in the United States in 2011 is 1%, between 1 and 1.5%. With induction, those rates are about 3 to 4%. So yes, you do seem to have an increased morbidity, maybe from the dissection, maybe because the patients who got induction have a worse performance status, who knows, although that's really not seen with the induction chemoradiation therapy group, a better performance status. With induction chemoradiation therapy, though, the morbidity goes up. It can be as high as 7 to 10% as far as mortality from operations like that. Depends also on the type of operation that you will do. And that's also a very controversial point, because in the literature, especially right pneumonectomies have been associated with increased chance of death postoperatively, either from adult respiratory distress syndrome or from some sort of bronchial problem. But recently, there's been some papers that say we can do pneumonectomies, and we need to define whether that should be revisited in patients having induction therapy. That's incredibly controversial. And in fact, though, in an NCCN poll of NCCN centers, of if you had a patient and you could do an R0 resection after induction and you could do a pneumonectomy, would you do it? And in that poll, 55% of the centers said they would. So there is a lot of disagreement about what to do with a patient who may have a pneumonectomy option after induction.
Could you review the sort of physiology of why right pneumonectomies can be more morbid than left?
55% on the right as far as lung function, 45% on the left. The question is whether you have bigger lung volumes. Second of all, as far as morbidity, the bronchial stump anatomically does not retract right underneath the arch of the aorta like it does on the left. It just sticks out there. So it's exposed to the elements, so to speak. So you have a greater chance of having some sort of bronchial problem. Third, it's been shown in the literature that if you give radiation on top of the chemotherapy, your bronchial flow to the stump goes down. So your healing becomes less. So your chance of having some sort of problem with the staple line increases. Finally, it's believed that the dissection of the lymphatics on the right side, which is a more extensive lymphatic dissection, the fours are right next to the trachea. The subcarinals are right there. The tens are right there. It's like a devascularization almost of the outside of the bronchus. It's believed that that may contribute to either ARDS, adult respiratory distress syndrome, or bronchial problems postoperatively.
So what's the follow-up on this patient?
Well, this patient got treated and then came back to see us, and the PET scan was completely negative. So this patient is one of the rare patients that had a radiologic CR and, in fact, has remained without disease, amazingly, since then.
He had surgery?
He did not have surgery because we discussed his case. So he got treated up to potentially curative levels of radiation, which is another thing that we do differently. Let me backtrack. So this is a patient with a single station lymph node, a lower lobe lesion, gets treated with induction chemoradiation therapy, has post-treatment staging, post-induction staging, and he's had a radiographic CR.
Including the primary?
Including the primary. So the primary is gone and the lymph node is gone.
Now, was the primary in the radiation field?
The primary got radiated also in a conformal way.
And is that the normal approach?
That is, at certain places, what will be done. Yes, you don't just radiate the mediastinum, you would radiate the primary also. But this was also one that was easy to radiate. So in that situation, you've got a patient that has node disease. And you have, in the literature, data that says, well, chemoradiation therapy alone may be as good as chemoradiation therapy and surgery. In the patient like this, it's possibly reasonable to go ahead and follow them. Why also do I have a greater feeling that this patient can be followed? Well, the patient got treated at curative levels of radiation therapy. That's not done everywhere. Many places still treat patients to 45 gray, which is not at the levels of 60 to 62 gray that have been shown that have greater tumoricidal capacity and can give you greater responses in the mediastinum. So we adapted that 4 years ago when that was already being looked at the RTOG. So this patient we did not operate on.
So how long has it been now since he was treated?
4 years.
Wow, 4 years. Well, of course, you know,
Always anecdotes. I mean, yeah. there's no doubt about that. But as a surgeon also, I have to ask myself, okay, this is a patient who will have a lobectomy, a 3% risk of operating on him. I have no radiologic evidence of disease. I've looked at the tumor as well as the lymph nodes, and it's remarkable that I don't see anything. So I'm going to put him through an operation that potentially could harm him when I think that he really has had a complete response. So we elected to follow him.
So let's talk about your lady who you did the mediastinotomy on.
So this is a 58-year-old female who was a former smoker, 30-pack years. She quit 10 years ago. Chest x-ray was performed for a usual physical exam, and a left lung nodule was detected. At that point, a CT and a PET CT was performed, and she was found to have a left upper lobe lesion as well as mediastinal lymph nodes. She had mediastinal lymph nodes that were in the level 5 position, which is the aorticopulmonary window, and she was presented at multidisciplinary conference to see what should be done with her. Because she had a PET-positive mediastinum without any lesions anywhere else, it was felt that we should document whether this patient indeed has mediastinal lymph nodes, and therefore she had a Chamberlain procedure as well as a bronchoscopy, which is a left parasternal mediastinotomy in which we evaluate the lymph nodes on the left side.
And why that as opposed to EBUS?
Because EBUS doesn't get the level 5 nodes well. It will get the level 4L nodes, which is right next to the bronchus, but the farther out you go, the poorer your yield is. Literally, you have to either go through the aorta or go through the pulmonary artery, and that doesn't work.
Yep. So what happened?
So we found that this lady indeed had mediastinal lymph nodes in the level 5 position.
What was the tissue?
It was a metastatic adenocarcinoma along with some granulomatous disease.
And again, that was the first diagnosis, or did you biopsy the primary?
That was the first diagnosis. So left the primary alone, went ahead and discussed her case and treated her with concurrent chemoradiation therapy.
Just sort of a by note, I meant to ask you this before. Do we know the frequency of using EBUS in clinical practice right now? And I assume, is it just done by surgeons or also pulmonologists?
We don't know the frequency, but it's rapidly increasing. And in reality, it is a pulmonary technique. In other words, the pulmonologists and bronchoscopists have adapted this, and surgeons are adapting it also. But it is the minority, I think, of thoracic surgeons that are doing it. It's mainly the interventional pulmonary people.
Interventional pulmonary people or pulmonologists?
Pulmonologists, people who do endobronchial ultrasound,
right.
People who have done transbronchial needle aspirates before, those people that were familiar with those techniques.
And at your place, same thing, or do you do it?
Both. We have pulmonologists that do it and have their own endoscopy suite, and then we have our own machines in the operating room. So both services actually do it.
And is it possible to get enough tissue for genomic analysis, EGFR, ALK fusion, for example?
That's a great question, and the answer is yes. And there have been a number of papers that talk about the technique to do that. It essentially means that you do more passes and you build up almost like a frozen section of cores that you've taken out onto a slide or onto filter paper, and then you can actually freeze that whole core, and then you almost have like a tissue aspirate.
But, I mean, you said it was a 22-gauge needle?
Yes.
So, for example, how many passes would equal, say, one core?
When I say core, when you aspirate with these things, when you push out the stuff through the needle, literally you get a long, stringy blood-like core. So that takes up some volume, and then you can just build upon it. So it would take about 4 to 6 passes, really, to get enough to build a nice pellet so that you can then freeze it.
So, for example, when you do a transthoracic biopsy, what size needle is that?
Oh, that can depend. You can get a 20-gauge, and you can get a core that will get you a wonderful histologic section that you could do a couple of passes of those, and you would just to make sure you have it, and then you'd have plenty to be able to do those tests.
And again, just from my own ignorant knowledge, what about if you're biopsying a peripheral lymph node? How large is the needle there when you get a core?
That can be even larger. That can be like an 18 because you have control and a supraclavicular space. So the closer the node is to you that you can feel it, the more daring you can be and you can get bigger cores.
And do you routinely send, for example, EGFR and save enough tissue for EML4 ALK? Or are you selective in the non-smokers? How do you approach it?
In my surgery cases that I operate on, essentially, everybody has their tumor sent out. Everybody. Adenocarcinomas, of course. And patients who have had a mediastinoscopy where there is plenty of tissue, and that's the only tissue that we have, we will send out also. Our techniques of being able to really send out cores on EBUSes is evolving. And it's only recently that the techniques to get enough have been talked about in the literature.
Have there been any situations where you had people, for example, with EGFR mutations, where you utilize an EGFR TKI like erlotinib as induction or as part of induction?
That's a wonderful question. It's been very rare, but we recently had a case, believe it or not, that was a male smoker that failed. He had an adenocarcinoma. He failed on pemetrexed, and then his mutational analysis came back, and he had an EGFR mutation. And we then put him on erlotinib, and he had a complete response.
Can you go back through that again? So what was his initial presentation?
Initial presentation was really not for induction. His initial presentation was a patient that had a large left upper lobe lesion and a rib lesion. So he had no mediastinal disease. So we thought he had an isolated site of metastasis to the rib. So we felt, let's treat him and see what happens. And maybe, you know, we'll make an anecdote. He did not respond to the usual agents.
So he had the primary biopsy?
He had the rib biopsied because there was a large soft tissue component around the rib, so they could get excellent core biopsies, which illustrates your point again. So the core biopsies were sent out for mutational analysis and came back as mutated.
And how old was he and what was his smoking history?
He had a smoking history that was sufficient. It was a lot. I mean, he had like 25 pack years, number one. And number two, he wasn't young. I mean, this was a 65-year-old gentleman.
It's really interesting comparing the approach in breast cancer, for example, where everybody gets ER and HER2, and in lung cancer, where kind of you try to decide whether or not, for example, to send these tests off. What prompted you to send it in this case?
Well, we have a very aggressive medical oncologist, and I think it depends upon the level of confidence that the medical oncologist has in the efficacy of the treatment. So his feeling is that, yes, there will be a cadre of patients, the majority, who don't fit the profile, but still it's reasonable to profile them.
So this patient then got pemetrexed and what, carboplatin? No bevacizumab?
No bevacizumab.
And you actually progressed or just didn't get better?
Progressed actually with evidence of disease in the spine now, and then was switched to erlotinib and had a complete response.
So what's the patient's current situation?
At this point, he's on erlotinib continuously.
Just out of curiosity, how did he do skin-wise?
He developed a rash, was treated with topical agents, and did fine.
So average kind of?
Correct.
And how long has it been that he's been on erlotinib?
6 months.
So how did you get involved? It was a case of metastatic disease, essentially.
This was one of those cases that gets referred in New York that is unusual, comes to me because he needs a diagnosis. And the question is, what's the easiest way to get a diagnosis? And I felt that the best way, we have very good interventionalists, was to get the soft tissue component of the rib, because I thought that was easier. And if they can get that, it wouldn't be a pneumothorax. And indeed, they did. And that's where the story evolved.
Let's get back to your 58-year-old woman. You biopsied a level 5 node.
We biopsied the lymph node and found that it had metastatic adenocarcinoma in a patient who was functionally in good shape, who would be able to tolerate maximal treatment. So again, we presented her at multidisciplinary conference and felt that she was a candidate to be treated with induction therapy. So she received, again, 60 gray of concurrent chemoradiation therapy. She again received etoposide cisplatinum. This was before the real changeover to pemetrexed. And she also had a nice response, mainly in the mediastinum, but still had disease in the lung primary. So we re-presented her case at conference, and it was felt that she was a candidate for resection because she could have a lobectomy, and it looked like she had a decent response in the mediastinum.
And so what's the follow-up?
Follow-up on her is that this is the case where you operate on, and you find that you did not have a complete response in the mediastinum. And we found that she not only had persistent disease in level 5, but also had disease in level 6 and did not have a complete response. So this patient, then, is one that you wonder about. Did you help them in operating and doing a lobectomy? That I say, can you quantify the degree of response and see whether that'll help? She received then postoperative treatment with docetaxel, which was the protocol at that point,
right?
And don't have follow-up on her at this point.
What have you observed in terms of toxicity to chemoradiation therapy? Any practical pearls about it? And are you seeing any difference in the patients who get PEM as opposed to etoposide cis?
To answer your second question first, I really don't see a difference between the two. I've really been involved in practices that are 95% always radiation and chemo. And my plans have always been that I try to operate on the patient within a 2 to 8 week period after the patient has completed their radiation therapy. That is more anecdotal, empirical than scientific. At this point, though, in my practice, it's incredibly important to stick to that because we've moved from the 45 gray to the 60 gray. And I do find that the dissection of the hilum at the 60 gray early is a little bit more tough than the 45 gray. Still very doable, but if you wait or if you have to come back on a patient that has had radiation and you're trying to operate on them then, it's a very, very difficult, dangerous case.
So when you say it's, quote, a little bit more difficult, is it fibrosis, inflammation,
yes,
or what?
Yes. It's trying to dissect the vessels off of the bronchus, trying to dissect the vessels off of lymph nodes that have obviously had a nice response. It's specifically the idea that the planes that were once there that you could just roll down with a surgical instrument no longer roll down, and you have to spend time trying to find those planes very carefully.
Anything else you want to comment on in terms of local treatment of lung cancer?
Be aware of the alternative approaches to early lung cancer that are coming around. In other words, SBRT. Segmentectomies as opposed to lobectomies, those are the buzzwords these days for surgical management of early lung cancer. And there is a trial that has been approved through the NCI that is now going to be a marginally resectable trial that will be comparing patients who have wedge or segmentectomy with or without the radioactive mesh versus stereotactic body radiation therapy. So patients will be randomized if they are able to tolerate a marginal resection to have that or have stereotactic body radiation therapy.
What's a marginal resection?
Patients who can't tolerate a lobectomy, patients who have pulmonary functions or other comorbid conditions that prevent them from having the standard type resection.
Is that the same trial I heard about a couple of years ago that started out as just, I'm trying to remember, wasn't there a surgery versus SBRT trial?
There was a, in the ACOSOG, the prelude to that trial that I just talked about was a trial that took marginally resected patients and randomized them to either have surgery or to have surgery plus a radioactive mesh or seeds that was done in the operating room. The other trial that you're thinking of is that there was a nationwide RTOG trial of 35 patients that were absolutely surgical candidates that did not have surgery. They had stereotactic body radiation therapy. That trial has completed accrual. I'm actually the PI, surgical PI on that trial, along with Bob Timmerman. And that trial now is incubating to see.
So it's just one arm?
That's just one arm. So it was a feasibility trial to see if multiple centers could do the same SBRT technique of three doses and see what the complications are, as well as the efficacy in patients who otherwise could have an operation.
You know, you wonder, do you really need a randomized study? There was one in prostate cancer, I think it was called the SPIRIT trial, surgery or radiation. They never got it accrued. I mean, it's really a tough trial to get patients on. Do you think we would ever study that, or are we just going to go use SBRT?
It's a great question. I think that that's why the first trial comparing surgery to SBRT is a marginally resected trial.
Right.
And what I've heard is that in Europe, there is a randomized trial of surgery versus SBRT, but that trial has had trouble accruing. And also, in some cases, they're not asking for histological documentation that it's a lung cancer. So it's a problem.
In what situations are you comfortable with SBRT in a patient who's surgically resectable? And I guess I'd be thinking about an older patient or a patient with comorbidities that you think can probably get through the surgery. How do you make that decision?
Boy, that's really tough. I mean, I think for a patient who comes to me, first of all, and says, I simply don't want surgery. I don't want you to operate on me. I'm not going to have anybody operate on me. And that patient has an outer third lesion or 2 centimeters away from the tracheobronchial tree, I have absolutely no problem in having them see our radiation oncologist to be evaluated for SBRT. Because I do feel that the response rates have been very, very exciting, and the control rates in the literature as well as in our own series has been very, very exciting. Now, the question is, what sort of mediastinal staging do you do on a patient like that, because you're not radiating the mediastinum? Well, if the patient is a peripheral lesion, which is where we're comfortable with doing SBRT, peripheral lesions have a risk of mediastinal metastases of only about 5 to 10%. And it's not standard policy that if you have a PET-positive peripheral lesion and you have negative lymph nodes that you're going to stage the mediastinum invasively anyway. So that's okay. With the marginally compromised patient, whether I'm going to do a wedge or whether I'm going to do an SBRT, if the patient has marginal pulmonary functions, meaning that their operation is going to keep them above an FEV1 of 0.8 liters per minute, and I can do a wedge or if I can do a segmentectomy, I prefer that at this point than to SBRT.
What about the older patient? And everybody always says, oh, well, it's all about performance status and not age. But I mean, you know, 90, 95, et cetera. How do you approach the really older patients?
Well, the really older patient who is very functional, that still is 90, but when he's in the office or she's in the office and looks like she's 80 and is very functional, you got to remember is still going to be 90 after you operate on them. But there's data in the literature that patients who are elderly, quote, that there is justification that if you can do even a wedge resection on those patients, they will derive benefit. So I do not exclude patients for a wedge resection on the basis of their age.
But what about SBRT as opposed to surgery?
SBRT, if you did a trial in elderly patients, I think that would be a good group to look at as opposed to the function. And I think it's reasonable. I mean, if the family gets consultation from us and they say, no, we don't want mom and dad to be operated on because of their age, I have no problems in having that patient go to SBRT either. Now, you only run into SBRT problems with complications, in my opinion, if you have patients who already have compromised pulmonary functions, because you will have a decrease in their pulmonary functions with time in those patients, but it'll be symptomatic only in the patients who had bad pulmonary functions to begin with. So what we're seeing in the functionally non-compromised patients, the ones in our surgical trials, their pulmonary functions stay pretty preserved.
How many treatments are involved with SBRT?
Depends upon the country you're in. If it's in the United States, it's three. So you have three doses, 20, 20, 20, and then it's three sessions. But the treatment planning, using a cradle, making sure that the breathing techniques are the same, I mean, that becomes the difficulty.
And as you were talking, I was thinking to myself, you know, God willing, I could be 95 years old and healthy, and I walk in with, you know, a peripheral lesion, you know, what would I do? And, you know, SBRT would sound pretty good. I don't know. What do you think?
I agree with you. No, I absolutely agree with you. And I think that if the trials that are so promising so far that show a disease control rate of 95% at 2 years that Bob has published, Bob Timmerman, then absolutely the practice is going to change, not only in the elderly patients, but I think in younger patients, but especially in elderly patients, certainly peripheral lesions. And I keep on emphasizing peripheral lesions because we don't know the toxicities of centrally placed lesions that get SBRT. The complications are higher.
What about the actual availability of this? I mean, I guess it's pretty similar to SBRT in the brain.
It is, but the techniques in the mediastinum with the movement of the diaphragm and the lung and the gating is very different. So certainly there are a number of centers that are doing it, and they do it in different ways. Some people use CyberKnife, which is a different type of treatment, and it's one dose, and they put fiducials in to the lesion so you can see it and get it. It's a lot of technology that's different, but I can't tell you how many centers, but certainly it's on the rise.
So just to complete, anything new and exciting in mesothelioma?
New and exciting is in the eye of the beholder. I think that for patients on the surgical front, people are finally realizing internationally that the way we classify and talk about operations that we do for mesothelioma doesn't make sense. I mean, we talk about extrapleural pneumonectomy, and then we sort of brush off pleurectomy. I mean, pleurectomy has been the weak sister because it doesn't really describe what a pleurectomy is. A pleurectomy can be an operation that can be as radical and take as long as an extrapleural pneumonectomy to get the patients down to the levels of disease that an extrapleural pneumonectomy accomplishes, especially in patients who have earlier disease. Why I bring this up is that the International Association for the Study of Lung Cancer is now putting out a white paper which actually describes the terminology for describing radical pleurectomies at this point and trying to adapt it. Why? Because the ISLC is also moving forward with a prospective registry for mesothelioma. So we really will see internationally how we're doing. With regard to the treatment that's non-surgical, the immunotherapy trials, the gene therapy trials with adenovirus, interferon, as well as TGF-beta continue at University of Pennsylvania and are promising, but we'll have to wait for a number of years for those to come through. And then the targeted agents that we thought would be useful, the PI3 kinase inhibitors, we really haven't seen much. So I think that the treatment or retreatment of meso hasn't changed since pemetrexed really was found to be the best agent up front for presenting stage four, as well as potentially even retreatment after the patients have had pemetrexed. The molecular inquiries of mesothelioma is also increasing, and certain centers are interested in the same genomic type of prediction with microRNAs and proteomics as in lung cancer. But again, those studies are in the discovery and validation phase.